Hi. No, we can't start like that. Okay, so welcome to the Living Poets Show. This is the first installation of our ongoing series. We're going to be on Fridays at, I believe, 3:15 to 3:45. We're going to be talking about and sometimes with poets who are alive and well and writing and reading. And so I'll introduce myself. I am one of your hosts. I'm Rebecca Wolf. I'm a poet and an editor and a reader. And I live in Athens, New York. And my co-host...
I'm Tommy Jacoby. I live in Germantown right now. I'm a reader, but I don't really... I'm not an editor.
But he is a guitar player, and he's going to be, for this very first occurrence of the Living Poets Show, we're here in my living room in Athens, New York, in part to demonstrate the fact that poetry is not just something on a page, but yet is more about a shared experience. And so here in my living room, we have not just Tommy and Rebecca, but also our friend Chris Stackhouse, Ira Scher, Sam Sebrin, Ron
Puhalski.
Many of us live in Athens, but we're here tonight to talk about poetry, and it's going to be Friday when you hear this. So part of what I'm interested in about that is the fact that... this is a very specific occasion, and so a poem is often a very specific occasion that yet pertains past its moment. And so radio can record a moment, and that is what we're going to do this time. And then we're going to record this moment of poems being shared in this room among these people, and you're listening. And then in the future, as we progress into living poets, because tonight we're going to be dealing with dead poets exclusively. But as we progress into the living, we will become more and more stultified in a certain sense by technology, and we will become ever more professional and present a more polished product. We've been speaking already tonight about several poets who jumped off bridges, and later we'll read a poem by a poet who jumped off a bridge, or actually jumped off a boat. But we're gonna begin. I thought it would be interesting to set the clock, to start the clock of poetry somewhat arbitrarily in 1874.
That's where it all began.
That's when it all began. And I thought first I would read a poem by Robert Frost, who is, in a way, he's sort of like the ultimate dead poet, you know, because he's a poet who many school children still learn. I sang in chorus in seventh grade. We had Two Roads Diverged in a Yellow Wood set to music, and we sang that poem. And so he sort of exemplifies, like, the poet that people know. Mm-hmm. Garrison Keillor probably has read a Robert Frost poem.
He slept with Robert Frost.
Yeah. He wishes he'd slept with Robert Frost. Yeah, so I'm going to read a Robert Frost poem, and then I'm going to read a poem by another poet who was born in 1874, who very few of you will ever have heard of. And that's just to quickly demonstrate the vagaries of posterity, how, you know, a poet can be alive in the moment and then be dead to immortality. I mean, you know, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
They pass. So So actually, what we're really going to do is we're going to play a recording of Robert Frost reading one of his own poems, coming to you loud and clear from the ages, Robert Frost, born in 1874.
In America.
In the U.S.
And sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler, and long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth, then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and not as wear, though as for that the passing there had worn them really about the same, and both that morning equally lay in leaves no step, had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on the way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I should be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in the wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference.
In case you couldn't totally hear that, I'm going to read it one more time. The road not taken. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler, long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other as just as fair claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear, though as for that the passing there had worn them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay, in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by. And that has made all the difference. I'm really tempted to sing for you the way that the last line was staged in my seventh grade chorus. It was highly elevated. It was a moment of great emotionality.
Whenever I hear that poem, I imagine it's being read in papyrus font. With like a sunset in the background, some footsteps. It was definitely on the wall of my third grade class, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But often sort of misunderstood, I think, as a poem of like, you know, and I did this rare, unusual thing, and it was the better thing to do.
Yeah.
It's not really, he never says that.
It seems to me to express complete ambivalence.
Yeah. But it's sort of one of the things that happens to Frost, is that people kind of often... they see him as being a simpler person than I
was. Or as having like a moral to the story.
Yeah, he's inspirational.
Yeah. Mm.
Right. Okay. That is completely not. And I think an interesting thing about this radio show is that tonight and on Friday, we won't really be trying to teach you much or impart a lot of knowledge about the different poets we're going to read. It's more... it seems to me more to be about introducing the combination of the temporality of the poems with their atemporality. So we're not going to try to read poets in chronological order. We're just kind of making a soup of dead poets. This is dead poets soup show. So this next poet is also was born in 1874, Elsa von Freytag Loringhoven. She was, you know, a poet in her time, published and socially accepted. And this poem is called A Dozen Cocktails, Please. No spinster lollipop for me. Yes, we have no bananas. I got lusting palate. I always eat them. They have dandy celluloid tubes, all sizes, tinted diabolically as a baboon's hind complexion. A man's a piffle, will-o'-the-wisp. What's the dread matter with the up-to-date American home comforts? bum insufficient for the should-be well-groomed upsy? That's the leading question. There's the vibrator, coy flapper toy. I am adult citizen with vote. I demand my unstinted share in Rufden, which Sabbath of our Babylonian obelisk. What's radio for, if you please? Eve's dart pricks snookums upon wire fence. An apple a day, it'll come. Ha, when? I'm no tongue-swallowing yogi. Progress is ravishing. It doesn't me. Nudge it, kick it, prod it, push it, broadcast. That's the lightning idea. SOS national shortage of what? How are we going to put up befitting lifted upsies? Psh, any sissy poet has sufficient freezing chemicals in his Freudian ice chest to snuff all cockiness. We'll hire one. Hell, not that. That's the trouble. Cock crow. Silly. Oh, fine. They're in France, the air on the line. The Poles. Have them send waves like candy. Valentines. Say it with bolts. Oh, thunder. Serpentine air currents. Psss. The very word penetrates. I feel woozy. I like that. I don't hanker after Billy Boys, but I am entitled to be deeply shocked. So are we, but you fill the hiatus. Dear, I ain't queer. I need it straight. A dozen cocktails, please.
Is that real?
That is real. That is a real poem.
When was that? That was like the 1920s?
Well, she died in 1927, so it was written before 1927.
Wow.
But that's, yeah. It's another kind of favorite, like, hidden secret of mine about poetry, hidden to the general reading populace, is that, you know, language kind of got cut loose a really long time ago, and
right.
And poets stopped making sense a long time ago,
yeah.
Too, and so it's a funny kind of, it's like the dueling banjos of deliverance. You know, you have like Robert Frost with sort of this lucid story that does or doesn't have a moral, but either way it's a narrative you can follow, and it kind of, you know, it's a road that he's traveling. And then
he's the first banjo.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's like the ding 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 ding. And then you have like this wild exploration going on at the same time.
Yeah, I always have the sense that like every poet who wrote before like 1950 had to, well, before 1930 had to rhyme. You know, it's like, I always thought that like free verse was this sort of like, I don't know, it was like this, it was this universal standard, and like all poets basically like before like the time I was alive are basically like just old fashioned and didn't really know, like didn't have like, they were just kind of these like Victorian fools who were like powdered wigs, you know, and just, like, they just had to, I don't know, they really didn't, they were never set free, you know. They never saw MTV like I did, so like they had no idea how cool the world can be or something.
They would just
so it's cool to hear it.
Rhyming. Yeah.
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 Well, when you were talking about like people from 1874, like born in 1874, it's, I mean, you have somebody like Rimbaud who published Illuminations in 1875, and it's, you know, and it is almost all free verse. And it's, you know, and it reads like a modern book.
Would you care to read one of these poems by Rimbaud? This is from the new translation by our hometown boy, John Ashbery, recently published by FSG, a new translation of Rimbaud's Illuminations, which are all prose poems. And maybe while you're looking for that one, I found another one by Rimbaud that I thought was pretty...
I'll just read the last poem from
there. Oh, okay.
It's called Genie. He is affection and the present since he opened the house to foaming winter and the hum of summer. He who purified drink and food. He who is the charm of fleeting places and the superhuman deliciousness of staying still. He is affection and the future, strength and love that we, standing amid rage and troubles, see passing in the storm-rent sky and on banners of ecstasy. He is love,
perfect and reinvented measurement, wonderful and unforeseen reason and eternity, machine beloved for its fatal qualities. We have all experienced the terror of his yielding of, and of our own. O enjoyment of our health, surge of our faculties, egoistic affection and passion for him, he who loves us for his infinite life. And we remember him and he travels. And if the adoration goes away, resounds, its promise resounds. Away with these superstitions, these old bodies, those couples and those ages. It's this age that has sunk. He won't go away, nor descend from heaven again. He won't accomplish the redemption of women's anger and the gaiety of men and all of that sin, for it is now accomplished with him being and being loved. Oh, his breaths, his heads, his racing, the terrible swiftness of the perfection of forms and of action. Oh, fecundity of the spirit and immensity of the universe, his body, the dreamed of release, the shattering of grace crossed with new violence. The sight of him, all the ancient kneeling and suffering lifted in his wake, his day, the abolition of all resonant and surging suffering in more intense music, his footstep, migrations more vast than ancient invasions. Oh, him and us, pride more benevolent than wasted charities. O world, and the clear song of new misfortunes. He has known us all and loved us all. Let us on this winter night, from cape to cape, from the tumultuous pole to the castle, from the crowd to the beach, from glance to glance, our strengths and feelings numb, learn to hail him and see him and send him back, and under the tides and at the summit of snowy deserts, follow his seeing, his breathing, his body, his day.
Yeah, okay.
Woof.
That was interesting, because while you were reading, something in your stentorian tones made me think...
And the kittens in the background
and
racing around the floor.
Kittens running around in the background, but
mm-hmm.
there was something... well, it was very prayer-like,
mm-hmm.
as you were reading, and it had some of the intonation of...
What has a Jesus quality, doesn't it?
The poem itself?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
the intonation
is
this
of
hymn.
This hymn,
kind of,
yeah. I did wonder...
This
I mean,
sort
I
of savior figure.
Read that poem on the page, but it made me curious. Yeah, how do you interpret the hymn in the poem?
Rimbaud was this sort of child prodigy. Did he live in Paris? Was it?
I think he traveled to Paris. I don't think he was born in Paris, but he entered Parisian life very young.
He was this sort of child prodigy who started writing poetry when he was a young teenager. Like Chris said, he was this really sort of like, he was like this raging teenager who had a relationship with another like a super successful poet,
Verlaine.
That's right.
Verlaine.
Who shot him? Yeah, that's right. And he ran all kinds of escapades all over Paris and had all kinds of relationships and had this really tumultuous relationship with Verlaine, and this went on for years and years. And eventually, I think by the age of 21, he decided he would never write a poem again. This is after he published this mind-blowing, like, landmark book of poems.
Well, and this book was actually... He gave this book to Verlaine before he left in this sort of journey that he did, this sort of mercantile journey from which he never returned. He gave this book to Verlaine without ever seeing it into the editor's hands. Verlaine had just gotten out of prison for shooting him. So they met for the first time Verlaine was out of prison. He gave the book to Verlaine, and then he went away. And he didn't even know that the book would ever see publication.
I find it really difficult to believe, just as a poet, or that he really stopped writing. That's what seems so interesting to me, is that I have a feeling that, you know, perhaps he decided to exit the world of publishing his poems, and I don't really know what the publication history in his lifetime was, but that's, I mean, something that seems really important to the whole conversation about poetry is, you know, what it... whatever that impulses to write. I guess, I mean, one of the possibilities is that his that he was writing to someone, you know, that he was always interested in writing specifically to someone. And we've thought a lot about poetic address and, you know, who the audience is for these utterances that make themselves into poems. And so maybe, you know, maybe the change in context would remove the need to write, but it just seems so unlikely to.
Can you think of other poets who stopped in that way? I know you can.
Yeah, for sure. Well, actually, Laura Riding, who's another poet I wanted to read something by, she chose specifically, I mean, she had a really interesting, I mean, her decision to stop writing in the middle of a career that was, or not a career, but a writing life that was very public and successful, had more to do with her feelings about the failures of poetry, and she has a volume called "The Failure of Poetry: The Promise of Language," I think, or maybe it's "The Promise of Language: The Failure of Poetry." But it was a really strict decision on her part that poetry as it was being enacted, could not fulfill its own tenets or something like that. I'll have to refine that paraphrase. But, you know, so there's various different reasons that people stop writing, but it seems it's such a personal thing at the same time to write. I mean, you don't write because you're thinking of where the writing will go in the moment. You know, you write because you want to write or feel that you need to write.
And certainly that gesture of basically giving the whole manuscript to somebody who might never see it to publication, you know, speaks to that.
Well, we're almost done here. So, Tommy, do you want to read a poem? I was going to read this other Rimbaud poem, but perhaps would you like to venture into somebody else?
Yeah, sure. Neruda, who, for those of you who don't know, he was a Chilean poet. He wrote in the early 20th century, published his first book in 1923 and published his last book in 1974, which is about the time he died. Lorca, Federico Garcia Lorca, who was a Spanish poet, said of Pablo Neruda, "And I tell you that you should open yourselves to hearing an authentic poet of the kind whose bodily senses were shaped in a world that is not our own and that few people are able to perceive. A poet closer to death than to philosophy, closer to pain than to intelligence, closer to blood than to ink." It's very intense, but I mean, you could probably say that about, like, Rimbaud, too. But I love Pablo Neruda, and I'm going to read a poem called Ode to the Dictionary. It comes from a book of odes that he wrote to these really arbitrary things like criticism and just, like, these really abstract, just these super abstract things that you wouldn't imagine, like, being able to be integrated into poetry. Ode to the Dictionary. Back like an ox, beast of burden, orderly, thick book, as a youth, I ignored you, wrapped in my smugness. I thought I knew it all, and as puffed up as a melancholy toad, I proclaimed, I receive my words in a loud, clear voice, directly from Mount Sinai. I shall convert forms to alchemy. I am the Magus. The great Magus said nothing. The dictionary, old and heavy in its scruffy leather jacket, sat in silence, its resources unrevealed. But one day, after I'd used it and abused it, after I'd called it useless and anachronistic camel, when for months, without protest, it had served me as a chair and a pillow, it rebelled and, planting its feet firmly in my doorway, expanded, shook its leaves and nests and spread its foliage. It was a tree, a natural, bountiful, apple blossom, apple orchard, apple tree, and words glittered in its infinite branches, opaque or sonorous, fertile in the fronds of language, charged with truth and sound. I turn its pages, caporal, capote, what a marvel to pronounce these plosive syllables, and further on, capsule, unfulfilled, awaiting ambrosia or oil, and others, capsicum, caption, capture, comparison, Capricorn, words as slippery as smooth grapes, words exploding in the light, like dormant seeds waiting again and giving life. Once again, the heart distills them. Dictionary, you are not a tomb, sepulchre, grave, tumulus, mausoleum, but guard and keeper, hidden fire, groves of rubies, living eternity of essence, depository of language. How wonderful to read in your columns, ancestral words, the severe and long-forgotten maxim, daughter of Spain, petrified as a plow blade, as limited in use as an antiquated tool, but preserved in the precise beauty and immutability of a medallion. Or another word we find hiding between the lines that suddenly seems as delicious and smooth on the tongue as an almond, or tender as a fig. Dictionary, let one hand of your thousand hands, one of your thousand emeralds, a single drop of your virginal springs, one grain from your magnanimous granaries, fall at the perfect moment upon my lips, unto the tip of my pen, and to my inkwell. From the depths of your dense and reverberating jungle, grant me, at the moment it is needed, a single bird song, the luxury of one bee, one splinter of your ancient wood perfumed by an eternity of jasmine, one syllable, one tremor, one sound, one seed. I am of the earth, and with words I sing.
Wow. That's great. And so interesting in light of the question of poetic address, right? Because odes, they're to something, but they sort of bounce off of whatever it is that they're addressed to, and they kind of like circle around the subject.
Right, yeah, it's not about, I mean, the ode to, let's say you write an ode to your girlfriend Amanda. It's not going to be about Amanda. I mean, it's more about what you're, I mean, it's more about you than it is about Amanda ultimately. And mm-hmm. It's more about your own, what it's just, essentially it's about the ode itself. It's what you want to put in the poem, whatever you think like is interesting framed in a poem. An ode is just kind of like an excuse. This Amanda would just be kind of an excuse.
She's
to like
my girlfriend for this whole ode thing.
Right. She's just sort of, she's like the glue that you stick things on, almost.
Mm-hmm.
And
like the love object itself.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Poetry. So I guess we're done for this time. And I hope you've enjoyed our Seat of the Pants poetry experience in the living room in Athens, New York, on this evening, which will be broadcast later. And going forward, we'll be exclusively addressing ourselves to living poets. So books that have come out, well, not necessarily even just books. We'll be having poets come into the studio to read for us. We'll be talking about the works of poets who are alive. And we hope you'll join us. Thank you.
Be alive too.
And be alive too.